and to tell them of what they must do. The longer Tagwin's story went on, the more ridiculous it sounded to Penn, and the more foolish he felt for coming even that far. What the King of the Silver River expected him to do, even if you accepted that it really was the King of the Silver River and not some malevolent shade, was patently impossible. For a boy with no practical magic to go alone into the Forbidding was so arrogant and pig-headed that no right-thinking person would even consider it. Penn didn't have to know the particulars of what lay behind the fairy magic that closed away the creatures of the Forbidding to know that he had virtually no chance of surviving a journey inside. He might be able to find and secure the Dark Wand from the Tanaquil, though that was debatable as well, but he saw no way he could reasonably expect to rescue the Ard Ris once he had done so. By the time Tagwin had concluded, Penn could not bring himself to look at R.N. Elicidal. He imagined himself in the other's shoes, thinking that he would dismiss this whole business in a heartbeat. The dwarf had been so certain R.N. would help them, but looking at it now, Penn couldn't see any reason why. He glanced over at the druid in spite of himself and found the other staring back. "This is a terrible responsibility you have been given, Penderin," R.N. Elicidal said quietly. "I am surprised you found the courage to accept it." Penn stared. It was not what he had expected the druid to say. "I was just thinking that it might have been a good idea to think it through a little more." "Are you worried that you acted in haste? Or that you might have been tricked in some way because it all sounds so incredible?" The elf nodded. "I remember feeling that way more than once during my time on the Gerald Shannara. I don't think you can avoid such feelings. Maybe second-guessing what you choose to do in difficult situations is necessary if you are to find peace of mind. Blind acceptance of what you believe to be the dictates of fate and circumstance is dangerous." "Do you think it really was the King of the Silver River?" Penn asked impulsively. The druid pursed his lips. "Your father met him years ago, on his way to Arbalon. He told me of the meeting later. He described it. Not so much how the King of the Silver River looked. That wouldn't matter anyway, because he can change his appearance. He described how it happened and how it made him feel." "Your experience sounds as if it was the same." "Yes, Penn. I think it was him." He glanced at Kyber, who was staring at Penn with rapt attention. "Kyber believes it was, don't you, Kyber?" She nodded at once. "I believe it all. But what are we going to do about it, Uncle Aaron?" "Sorry. What are you going to do about it?" she corrected herself. "I told the boy to come here," Tagwin confessed, straightening. "It's my fault we have involved you in this. But I know how you feel about the Ard Ris, and I couldn't think of anyone else to turn to. I don't think we can do this on our own. We managed to get this far on grit and luck." He grimaced. "I can't imagine how we will get all the way into the charnels alone." "But we can if we have to," Penn added quickly. Tagwin shot him a withering glance. "You have more confidence in what we can accomplish than I do, Penderin." R.N. Elicidal smiled ruefully. "Confidence isn't to be discouraged, Tagwin, nor overrated, Penderin. Remember, we seek a balance in all things."
"But you will help them, won't you?" Kyber pressed eagerly.
"Of course I will help. The Ard Ris has been both mentor and friend to me. I would never abandon her or those who feel about her as I do." He paused, looking again at Tagwin. "But much of what you have told me is troublesome. I think there is still a great deal about this business that we don't know. Shadair Aru, Terek Molt, and those others are dangerous, but they lack sufficient power to imprison the Ard Ris within the Forbidding. It took the magic of an entire elven nation to create the Forbidding in the first place. Nothing passes through the barrier except when the Elkris fails. She doesn't do so now, so far as I know." He glanced at Kyber for confirmation.
"She was well when I departed Arbalon a week ago," she said.
"She wouldn't have declined so precipitously without our hearing about it," Aaron continued. "No, some other force is at work here. Something hidden from us. We may not find out what it is until we reach the Ard Ris, but we must be wary of it." He paused.
A more immediate problem is that those who have worked against the Ardres will be searching for Penn. They will not stop simply because he has escaped them once. Perhaps they realize that he has the potential to help her. Perhaps they are simply looking to tie up loose ends. The King of the Silver River helped you escape once, Penn, but he will not be able to help you a second time. You are beyond his reach now.
They were searching for my father when they came to Patch Run, Penn pointed out. Maybe they will forget about me and go after him.
The druid shook his head. They will keep looking. Eventually they will find you. So we must act quickly. Do you have any idea at all where in the charnels the Tanaquil can be found?
Penn shook his head. Only what the King of the Silver River told us, that it grows on an island beyond the ruins of a city called Stride Gate, and that Urdas and trolls might help us find the way. Nothing more than that.
I can use earth magic to try to seek it out through lines of power and air currents, the druid mused, looking off into the woods as if he might find the answer in the trees. But that approach is uncertain. We need something more definite.
What you need, Kyber declared suddenly, are the elf stones, the seeking stones.
Penn knew the stories of the elf stones, which had been given by the druid Alanon to Shay Omsford to aid him in his search for the Sword of Shannara, and then had been held for many years by other members of the Omsford family. They had been returned to the elven people during the reign of Ren Elicidal, an Omsford cousin, and remained there until they disappeared with Kael Elicidal 50 years earlier. Aran Elicidal had recovered them on the voyage of the Gerald Shannara and given them to his brother in exchange for help in forming the Third Druid Council.
Aran frowned.
What do you know of the Elfstones, Kyber?
Enough, from listening to my father and brother. They spoke of them often before my father's death, usually when they thought I couldn't hear. They believed the stones could be used as a weapon against the Federation.
The druid thought about it a moment.
Well, I won't deny that the elf stones would help us. But I don't have possession of them, or any reasonable hope of persuading your brother to lend them to me. We will have to find another way.
Maybe not. Kyber reached in her tunic and produced a small pouch. With a determined, almost defiant look, she held it out.
I took them from their hiding place because I wanted you to teach me how to use them. I was going to tell you later when I found the right way to do so, because I knew you would be angry with me. But I guess I can't wait any longer, so here they are. If you want to be angry, go ahead.
She thrust them at her startled uncle, who immediately said, Kyber, you have gone too far.
Her lips compressed defiantly. My brother refuses even to look at them since our father died. They serve no purpose being locked away. Besides, I have as much right to use them as any other member of the family. The elf stones belong to all the elves. The Elicidals are caretakers and nothing more. Someone has to learn to use them. Why not me?
Because you are not king of the elves and do not have his permission, Aran snapped, balancing the pouch in his palm as if weighing the option of throwing it into the trees. What will happen when Kellen finds out what you have done? You won't be making any more trips to Emberon.
Kyber shrugged. He won't find out. I replaced the elf stones with pebbles. As I said, he never even looks at them. In any case, that's not what's important. What's important is the Ardres. Uncle Aran, we can use the elf stones. We can find the Tanaquil with their magic. You know we can. Don't you want to help Penn and Tagwin?
Aran Elicidal flushed angrily, his composure beginning to slip. Don't twist my words, Kyber. I know what matters. I also know a great deal more about the use of the elf stones than you do. They are a dangerous magic. Using them has consequences you know nothing about. Ask Penderin about his family history. Why in the world did you think I would agree to this? What makes you think you should be the one who knows how to use them?
Because no one else dares, she snapped. No one but me. If I am to be a druid, I should know how magic works in all its forms. You teach me earth magic, and that can have consequences as well. Aren't I careful with the earth magic? Don't you think I would be careful with the elf stones, too? Don't you trust me? Anyway, things have changed.
I have given you the stones so that you can help Pen and Tagwin. Are you going to do so or not?
She glared at him, and Pen found himself holding his breath in astonishment. He would never have dared to talk to the druid that way. Whatever bond she shared with her uncle, it was much stronger than he had imagined. She wasn't afraid of him at all, not intimidated in the least. He risked a quick glance at Tagwin, who seemed equally surprised.
If you use the elf stones, you can discover if what the King of the Silver River told Pen is true, she continued insistently. You can see whether or not there is even a tentacle to be found. Then we can at least know whether there is a chance of helping the Ardreese by looking for it.
It was hard to argue with logic like that, and Arran Elicidal didn't even try. He gave his niece a final look of reproof, then opened the pouch and poured the contents into his hands. The elf stones glimmered a deep blue in the midday sun, their facets mirroring the world about them in prismatic colors. There were three of them, perfectly formed, flawless, and beautiful. Pen remembered the legends. One elf stone each for the heart, mind, and body, together forming a whole that responded to the strength of the user. Only those born of elven blood could use them, and only if they were freely given or claimed by the user. Once they had belonged to the Ohmsfords, and it was Will Ohmsford's inadvisable but necessary use of them to help the elven girl Amberley that had altered his body and passed on to his scions the magic that was dying out with Pen.
I will use the stones, Kyber, Arran Elicidal said, because you are right in believing that only by using them can we be certain that the Tanaquil is real. If the elf stones reveal it to us, then we know the journey to reach it should be made. But understand something else. I spoke of consequences. By using the stones, I risk revealing our intentions to Shadair Aru and her allies. The elf stones are a powerful magic, and its release will be detected. When that happens, those we seek to escape will come looking.
They will come anyway, Uncle Arran, Kyber pointed out defensively. You just said so.
Arran nodded. But now they will come sooner. By nightfall, in all probability. We will no longer have time to think about what we are going to do. The decision will have been made. We will have to leave Emberon, Penderyn, Tagwin, and myself in search of the Tanaquil, and you back to Arbalon. Kyber Elicidal shook her head at once.
I'm going with you. I have no other choice. Uncle Arran, please let me finish before you say anything. You are going to take the elf stones with you because you know you will need them again. Since I can't return home without them, I will have to go as well. But there is another reason, an even better one. If something happens to you, neither Pen nor Tagwin can use the stones because they aren't elves. That leaves me, if you teach me how. I know it isn't what you want. I know you don't like the idea. But you know it's necessary. Finding and rescuing the Ardreese is what matters. She paused.
I want this, Uncle Arran. I want to help. I want to do something besides sit around in Arbalon and wait for my family to marry me off. I want my life to matter. Please, let me come.
He studied her for a moment, then turned to Tagwin. Is there any other druid at Perenor that we can trust to come with us? Tagwin frowned and pulled absently at his beard. If you're asking me if there is anyone I can be sure of, the answer is no. I trust some more than others, but at this point I don't know how deep the conspiracy goes. You know how things are as well as I do. He squared his shoulders. I think we ought to take her with us. She's older than this boy, and she's able. We might need her. I don't like to think about it, but something could happen to any of us. The rest have to be able to carry on.
Arran Elicidal shook his head in dismay.
I regret agreeing to let you listen to this conversation in the first place, Kyber. This isn't something you should be involved in.
It isn't something any of us should be involved in, she replied.
But we all are, aren't we?
Let me come.
He took a long time making up his mind, and Pen was certain that he was going to say no. Pen's parents would have said no to him had they been in a position to do so. Parents didn't want their children taking the sort of risks involved here. Parents wanted their children safe at home.
He didn't think it was any different with uncles and nieces. All right, Aran said finally, surprising them all. You can come with us, mostly because I can't think of what else to do with you. Sending you home will just get you in worse trouble, and whatever trouble comes of this ought to be mine. But you must agree to do as I say, Kyber. Whatever I tell you to do on this journey, you do it. No arguments, no excuses. I know you. I know how you think. Give me your word. She nodded eagerly.
You have it.
Aran sighed, tightened his fingers about the elf stones, rose from the table and stretched out his arm. His eyes closed in concentration, but his face remained calm.
Stand back from me, he said softly. Watch carefully what the magic shows. Remember it well.
Not certain what to expect, they backed away from him, eyes riveted on his outstretched hand. Slowly his fingers opened to the light. His concentration deepened. The seconds crawled past. Then abruptly light exploded from the crystals in a deep cerulean starburst, brightened until the sun itself disappeared behind the enveloping blue, then shot away into the distance in a blinding flare. It arced away through the trees and beyond, through mountains and hills and the curve of the earth itself. Some of what they saw was recognizable. The dragon's teeth and the charnels, the myrmidon and the charred rush, even the sweep of the Strelaheim and the dismal emptiness of the Maug. Forests came and went, one a shelter for gardens that eclipsed in beauty and complexity anything they had ever seen, a profusion of flowers and silvery waterfalls painted against a shimmering backdrop of green. When the light finally came to rest, somewhere so far away that the distance could barely be calculated, it was illuminating a strange tree. The tree was huge, larger than the black oaks of Callahorn, broad-limbed and wide-leafed. Its bark was smooth, a mottled black and gray. Its leaves were deepest green with an orange border. The tree was bathed in dappled sunlight and surrounded by a dense forest of more familiar trees, oaks, elms, hickories, maples, and the like. Beyond the trees, nothing was visible. The tree seemed incredibly old, even in the wash of the elf stone's light, and Penn felt certain as he looked upon it that it was as old as faerie. He could feel its intelligence, even in what was no more than a vision. He could sense its life force, slow and rhythmic as a quiet heartbeat. The blue light held steady for a moment, then flared once and was gone, leaving the watchers staring at nothing, half blind and stunned by the suddenness and intensity of the experience. They blinked at each other in the ensuing silence, the image of the tree and its surroundings still vivid in their minds. Aran Elicidal closed his fingers about the elf stones.
"Now we know," he said.
"Or think we do," Tagwin grumbled. Penn swallowed against a sudden tightness in his throat. He was dizzy at what seeing the tree had made him feel deep inside where instincts governed thought.
"No, Tagwin, that was it," he said softly. "I could feel it. That was the Tanaquil."
Aran Elicidal nodded.
"We are settled on what we must do."
He dumped the elf stones back into their pouch and tucked the pouch into his tunic.
"Time slips away, and it doesn't favor us by doing so. Let's move quickly."
Chapter 14. Midday at Paranor was dark and forbidding, the skies gone black with storm clouds, and the air as still as death. There had been no sunlight all day, only a hazy glow at sunrise before the enveloping clouds screened even that away. Birds had long since gone to roost in sheltering havens, and the winds had died away to nothing. The world was hushed and waiting in expectation of thunder and lightning and fury. Shadea Aru glanced through the open window of her chambers, her face a mirror of the weather. She should have felt triumph and satisfaction, a reward for her successes. She had dispatched Grianne Omsford into the Forbidding and taken her place. The Druid Council, albeit with some reluctance and after considerable debate, had named her Ardreese. Her cohorts controlled all the major positions on the Council, and Sen Dunsedain, as Prime Minister of the Federation, had officially recognized her as head of the Order. The rock trolls under Kermadec had been dismissed and sent home in disgrace, blamed for the disappearance of the Ardris, and, in more than a few corners, suspected as the cause for it as well. Everything had worked out perfectly, exactly as she had hoped and planned. Except for that boy. She ran her fingers distractedly through her chopped-off blonde hair, letting the short ends slip through her fingers like the loose threads of her perfect plan. It was all because of Taric Molt, who was the most reliable of her co-conspirators and the one druid she thought she could depend upon. To let that boy, that slip of a boy, make a fool of him like that was unforgivable. It was bad enough that none of them had thought to lock up Tagwin, who they should have known would not sit idly by and do nothing after his beloved Ardris disappeared, but to lose the boy as well was too much. She should have taken care of the matter herself, but it was impossible for her to do everything. She stalked to the door and stood staring at it a moment, thinking to go out again to calm herself. She had walked the corridors earlier, an intimidating presence to the druids she now commanded. They would obey her because she was Ardris, but also because they were afraid of her. No one would challenge her openly while she had the backing of Molt and the others, and the Ardris was gone, though some would plot behind her back, just as they had plotted against Grianne Ohmsford. She could do nothing about them until they tried to act, but she could let them know she was watching and waiting to catch them out. She walked back to the window and looked out again. The first sharp gusts of wind were rippling the tree limbs, signaling the approach of the rainstorm. She had half a mind to put all of them out into it, every last druid, to make them hike to the Kennon Pass and back again as an exercise in deprivation and humility. Some of them might not come back, and it wouldn't make her unhappy if they didn't. Her thoughts returned to Tagwin and the boy. They might have escaped her for the moment, she thought, but sooner or later she would find them again. The parents as well. She had druids and airships looking for all of them and had put out the word to all corners of the Four Lands. She had kept it simple. The ones she sought were members of Grianne Ohmsford's family, and they were in danger. Help could be given them at Perrinor, where their druid protectors would keep them safe. Anyone seeing them was to send word. As incentive, she had offered a substantial reward. Most would ignore the offer, but the greedy among them would look around. Someone would see the boy and his dwarf companion and report them, and when they were found, she would deal with them herself. She was contemplating the satisfaction that enterprise would give her when a sharp knock sounded, and without bothering to wait for her to respond, Taric Molt barged in. "What do you think you are doing?" she snapped at him. "Rooms have doors for a reason, Molt." "We've found them," he rumbled in his deep, subterranean voice, ignoring her. "West, across the Myrmidon." She started. "Tagwin and the boy?" "Only moments ago, someone used elfstone magic. It was visible on the scry waters in the cold chamber. Iridia was there to see it. There is no mistaking what it is." The cold chamber was where the druids read the lines of power that crisscrossed the Four Lands. The scry waters were the table of liquid on which all uses of magic revealed themselves as ripples that indicated the extent of the power expended. Grianne Ohmsford herself had implemented it at Perrinor more than a dozen years ago, a tool she had employed as the Ill's Witch. "Elfstones?" she asked. She did not yet understand the connection. "Of course, Shadea," he said, smiling with such satisfaction that she wanted to tear his face off. "They've escaped us and gone for help from the one druid who might actually give it." "The Elven Prince," she hissed. "But he doesn't have the use of the Elfstones. His brother keeps them." "Not so well protected that he couldn't get to them if he chose. He would do so to save the Ardris." "No, it has to be him. The readings come from that part of the Westland where he keeps his home. Tagwin would know to go there and take the boy with him." "I am surprised they chanced using the stones. Aran Elisidor must know we will be watching for any use of magic." "But how else can he find the Ardris?" Molt pointed out. "He has no choice but to use the stones." She nodded slowly, thinking it through. "True enough.
He can't know what we've done to her, even if he suspects we're responsible, unless he uses the stones. She hesitated. Wait. Did you say that Iridia was the one who discovered this use?
Terek Malt's laugh was low and rough. I thought of that, too. I asked her if she was certain. She insisted that there was no mistake. It was elf stone magic. I told her she had better be sure, since you would question it. She is waiting to speak with you in the cold chamber.
He paused, a faint smile twisting his mouth at the corners. She wants to be the one to go after him.
I would expect nothing less.
Such a fool. She walked to the window and stared out at the darkening skies. She could not leave the matter to Iridia, but then Terek Malt had not proved particularly adept at settling things either. She should do this herself, yet she did not think it wise to leave Paranor just yet. She was too newly settled in as Ard Rhys. Someone else must make certain that Tagwin and the boy, and now Arryn Elicidal as well, did not succeed in their efforts.
Perhaps we should let this matter lie, Terek Malt said quietly. After all, even if they know what we have done with the Ard Rhys, there is nothing they can do to help her.
Is that so? She asked, without bothering to look at him. Are you so certain?
Certain enough.
You assume too much. Besides, they can cause us a great deal of trouble, even if they cannot reach her. I don't want to chance it. Better that we remove them from the picture.
That could cause us more trouble still. Others will know what we have done. Killing a boy and an old man is one thing. Killing a druid is something else again. That's what you intend, isn't it?
I intend to do whatever is necessary to make certain our efforts do not fail. I expect you to do likewise. She turned back to him.
Ready the Gallifile, but do not tell Iridia.
I don't trust her in this matter, not where Arryn Elicidal is concerned. She may think she can blind herself to her feelings, but I don't care to chance it. Better that she remain here.
I will tell her after you are gone.
Given the look of the weather, you won't leave today. If the storm passes by nightfall, leave then.
He turned for the door.
Stay a moment, she said.
I have more to say to you.
Heed me well.
Are you listening, Terek?
The dwarf turned back slowly, brow darkening in anticipation of what he knew was coming.
Speak your mind, woman.
First, she said, walking over to stand directly in front of him. Don't come into this room again until you are invited. Not for any reason. She waited for his response. He grunted and shrugged.
Second, don't fail me again. I would not be pleased if you did.
He laughed.
I am less concerned about pleasing you than pleasing myself, so spare me your threats. The matter of finding and dispatching the boy and the old man has become personal. I don't like to be tricked. They used magic of some sort or I would have had them. I intend to see that accounts between us are settled.
She held his fierce gaze a moment, then nodded. Fair enough. But that may not prove to be so easy now that you must contend with Arryn Elicidal as well. Dispatching him may prove troublesome, even for you. So I am sending someone to help.
The dwarf glowered at her.
Who? If not Iridia?
Another druid would only muck up the waters.
You don't need another druid to get this business settled.
She paused. I'm going to send Aphasia Y.
Terek Malt turned his head aside, though barely, and spit very deliberately on her carpet.
No.
This isn't open to debate.
I won't put that monster on any ship I command. Get someone else if you think you can.
I don't want anyone else. If I wanted someone else, I wouldn't be talking with you.
Where is your backbone?
Are you afraid? Think how it will look if you stay behind after failing so badly the first time. Some will see it as a weakness, and you can't afford that. She drew her robes about her in a dismissive fashion.
Be smart about this, druid. You are the best of the lot, and you know it.
I depend on you. Don't make me question my faith in you. You've never had faith in anyone but yourself, Shadea. Think what you want. What matters is that you understand that Aphasia Y is coming with you. Stop worrying. He won't dare to cross you. The dwarf snorted derisively. Aphasia Y will cross anyone if opportunity allows for it. He is a monster, Shadea. There isn't anything that creature won't do, or anyone he won't do it to. Shades, we don't even know what he really is. She laughed. He's the most efficient assassin I have ever seen. What more do you want him to be? I don't care what sex or race or breed he is. I don't care how loathsome you find him. You're not partnering with him. You're putting him to work. Stop whining. Tarek Molt was seething. His chiseled face turned red. The muscles of his forearms knotted. He was as dangerous at that moment as she had ever seen him, and if she was foolish enough to give him an opening, he would kill her before she could blink. But she faced him down, keeping his eyes locked on hers and making him see that no matter how dangerous he was, she was more dangerous still. "Don't even think it, dwarf," she hissed softly. "Remember who I am." He glared at her a moment longer, then looked away, furious still, but no longer threatening. "Someday you will go too far with me, Shadea." His voice was eerily calm. "Be careful of that day." "Perhaps," she replied, reaching past him to open the door. "But until then you will listen to me when I tell you what to do. Go ready the airship. When the storm passes, you will sail at once." His big hands tightened into fists as he considered saying something more. Then, without doing so, he turned his back on her and walked away. She waited until he was well away and her frustration with his recalcitrance had faded before she departed for the cold chamber to find Iridia Ilari. The sorceress would not be happy with what Shadea intended to tell her. Unfortunately, disappointing Iridia was unavoidable, because the sorceress was only as reliable as her control over her feelings about Aran Elicidal, which meant she was not reliable at all. Iridia had set her mind on the matter long ago, and Shadea was not going to be able to change it, even if she tried. Love was like that. Denial only sharpened its edges. Shadea entered the cold chamber and found Iridia standing at the broad stone basin set in its center, bending close as she read the movement of its contents. The scry waters were shallow and deep green, shielded from the elements by the walls of the tower and the sides of the basin. Disturbances came solely from magic channeled through the earth's lines of power. Just then they manifested themselves as concentric ripples fanning out from a point just west of center. Iridia's slender hands moved in time to the ripples, as if to trace their liquid ridges back to her doomed love. Her perfect features radiated her intensity, a mix of light and dark, pale skin and black hair. Her elven features were drawn taut by her concentration, emphasizing what could be both passionate and cruel about her. Shadea stood in the doorway and watched her for a long time, observing. Iridia, captive to her memories and her dreams, didn't even know Shadea was there. It was possible that the madness Iridia had always seemed so close to embracing was finally coming to her. "Iridia," she called sharply. The sorceress turned at once. "Have you heard?" Shadea walked over to her. "Tarek told me of it. Is there no chance that you are mistaken?" The delicate features hardened. "What do you take me for? I don't make mistakes of that sort. It was elf stone magic, which means it could be him. I want to make certain of it, Shadea. You will have to send someone in any case. It should be me." Shadea shook her head. "It should be anyone but you. What will you do if you find him and he looks at you and you cannot act? Don't tell me it cannot happen, because I know better. I was there, Iridia, when you lost him. You were inconsolable for weeks. He was the one you wanted, the one you will always want." "I don't deny that," she snapped, "but that part of my life is over. I am committed to our efforts here. If he stands in our way, if he acts to help her, then I want him dead. I have the right to watch him die. I ask nothing more than that. If he is to be killed, I want to be there to see it. I want my face to be the last face he sees in this life.
Shadea sighed. You only think you want that. What you want is for him to take you back again, to tell you that he loves you still, despite what has happened.
If he were to do so, you would abandon your cause and us in a heartbeat.
No, wait, Iridia, don't lie to yourself. You would, and you know it.
Why wouldn't you? I don't condemn it. I would do the same in your place.
You would do nothing of the sort, the other woman sneered. You have never loved anyone but yourself. Don't pretend to understand me. I know love compels me, but it compels me in ways other than those you seem so quick to attribute. Love doesn't compel me to embrace him. It compels me to see him suffer.
Yes, but not at your hands.
Shadea moved away, gazing out the tower window at the unfolding darkness and roiling storm clouds. Outside, the wind began to howl and the rain to fall in heavy curtains that lashed the stone walls.
Better at my hands, where we can be certain of the result, than at the hands of Terek Molt, who has already failed us once.
Better at another's hands entirely. I am sending Aphasia Y to make certain the job is done right. She glimpsed Iridia's face out of the corner of her eye, and the look confirmed what she had already decided about the other's feelings for Aran Elicidal.
Iridia, she said softly, turning back, distance yourself from this matter. Leave it to others to determine what is needed. You have suffered enough at the hands of the Elven Prince. He has betrayed you already and would do so again. His loyalty is to her, not to you. That will never change. To place yourself in a position where you must test your resolve is foolish and dangerous. It asks too much of you.
The sorceress stiffened, her lips tightening to a thin, hard line, her perfect features cast in iron.
And you think too little of me. I am not a fool, Shadea. I am your equal, and in some ways your better. I have experiences you do not. Don't be so quick to dismiss me as a lovesick child.
I would never do that.
You not only would, you do.
Iridia's glare would have melted iron. If Aran Elicidal has used the Elfstones to try to help that woman, I want him dead as much as you do. But I want to see it happen. I want to watch him die.
Do you? Shadea Aru paused.
I would have thought you'd had enough of that sort of thing. How many more of those you profess not to love but secretly do must you watch die before you are satisfied?
Iridia's face went white. What are you talking about?
There was an unmistakable warning in her words.
Shadea ignored it, her gaze cold and empty.
The baby, Iridia. You remember the baby, don't you? You didn't love her either.
For a long moment, Iridia neither moved nor spoke, but simply stared at Shadea, the look on her face one of mixed incredulity and rage. Then both drained away with frightening swiftness, leaving her features calm and dispassionate.
Do what you want, she said.
She turned and walked away without looking at Shadea. As she went through the door, she said softly,
I hate you. I'll see you dead, too.
As Iridia disappeared down the tower stairs, Shadea glanced after her, thinking for just a moment that she should go after her, then deciding otherwise. She knew the sorceress. Iridia was quick to anger, but she would think the situation through and realize she was being foolish. It was better to let her be for now. She looked down at the scry waters in the basin. The ripples had disappeared. The surface had gone completely still. Aran Elicidal would be made to vanish just as swiftly. One last task remained to her, the one she dreaded most.
She had no more love for Aphasia Y than did Tarek Molt, but she found him useful in carrying out assignments that others would either refuse or mishandle. She had already seen enough of the latter in the hunting down of Grian Omsford's family, and the task would get no easier with Aran Elicidal added to the mix. Tarek Molt might protest her decision, but it was a matter of common sense and expediency. One druid of her inner circle was all she cared to spare for the venture, and one was probably not enough. As she passed through the towers and hallways of the keep, by sleeping rooms and meditation chambers, the resting and the restless, her mind focused on the task ahead. She wanted the business over, but not before she had accomplished what was necessary. She had given the matter considerable thought since Tarek Molt's return. It was a mistake. Her mistake, unfortunately, to have thought of the patch-run Omsfords as ordinary people. The boy and his parents might not be druids, but that did not render them commonplace. The magic that was in their blood and their long history of surviving against impossible odds made them dangerous. It would require a special effort to overcome both, one that she would not underestimate again. It would help that she had the services of Aphasia Y, but something more was needed. She descended the winding stairways of the keep into its depths, into the cellars and dungeons that lay far underground in the bedrock, dark places where the druids seldom ventured. Her destination was known only to her now that Grian Omsford was gone, a place she had discovered some years ago while shadowing the Ardris in an effort to discover her secrets. She had been good at shadowing even then, having developed the skill in her early years, when the uses of magic were first revealing themselves to her. It was dangerous to challenge Grian Omsford's instincts, but she managed it with the aid of a fine-grained, odorless dust that rendered the other's tracks visible in a wash of prismatic light. Layering the dust in the dark places she knew the other sometimes went, she would wait for her return before sneaking back down to read the trail. She had gotten lucky once or twice, but never again as lucky as with what she now sought to retrieve. She entered the deep center of the keep, the heart of the fortress, down where the earth's heat lifted out of its churning magma to warm the rooms above. She found it interesting that the druids would build their home atop a volcanic fissure that might erupt and destroy them one day. But the druids lived in harmony with the earth's elements and found strength in what was raw and new. She understood and appreciated that. A proximity to the sharp edge that divided life and death was compelling for her as well. The passageways narrowed and darkened further. So far down there was no need for space or light. She thought that some of the corridors had not been walked in 1,000 years, that some of the cells and rooms they fed into had not seen life in thousands more. But she sought nothing of life that day, only of death. She moved in silence, listening for sounds of the spirit creature that lived in the pit beneath the keep and warded Perenor and its magic. It slept now and would slumber until awakened. So long as the druids kept occupancy and life, it would lie dormant. She knew the stories of its protective efforts. The stories were legend. They did not frighten her, however. Rather, they intrigued her. One day she would come down to take a closer look at it. Spirits were something she understood. She pondered for a moment the circumstances that had led her to that moment. She had no regrets about how she had achieved her position, but she would have preferred that it be otherwise. She wasn't evil, just practical. She was the right choice to be Ardris, the better person for the title, but that did not mean she was happy with the way she had obtained it. Climbing over the backs of others to get what you wanted was suited more to politicians and to royalty than to students of magic. She would have preferred to face Grian Omsford in combat, but a decision based on the outcome of trial by magic would not have been accepted by the others, neither her allies nor her enemies. Druids, for all their examination and study, were conservative by nature. History had taught them that independence and disobedience led to disaster, so they preferred that matters progress in an orderly fashion. That couldn't happen here. Not with the ills which, as Ardris, and the fate of the Order hanging in the balance. Shadea had understood that from the beginning. Unlike the others, she had chosen to act. She reached a heavy iron door at the end of a corridor and stopped. Placing her fingers on a set of symbols cut into the metal, she closed her eyes and pressed in deliberate sequence. It had taken her a while to unlock the puzzle, but in the end, she had done so. Tumblers clicked and a bolt slid back. The door opened. Inside, the room was round and dark, save for a single flameless lamp set in a raised stanchion at the chamber's center. Heavy stone blocks encircled a mosaic floor in which runes had been carved in intricate patterns that suggested story panels. There was only the one door leading in and no windows. There were no openings in either the walls or floor. The ceiling domed away in shadowed darkness. A tomb for the dead and their possessions, Shadea thought. A space where things were placed with a strong expectation that one day they would be forgotten. She walked to the stanchion, stood with the heel of her right boot pressed against one edge of its square base and fitted into an invisible depression beneath, then walked straight ahead until she reached the wall. Placing the palms of both hands flat against the stone at waist height, she worked the tips of her fingers around until she found the hidden depressions in the stone, then pushed. A heavy panel swung open on hidden hinges, revealing a deep, ink-black chamber. Her smile said everything about her expectations for what waited within. She entered without the use of fresh light, relying on the faint glow of the lamp behind her. Her eyes adjusted quickly, and she saw what she had come for. She walked over to a low pedestal set against one wall, opened the iron box sitting on top of it, and took out the velvet pouch that rested within. She handled it carefully, the way she might a deadly snake, taking care not to grip it too strongly, but to balance it in the palms of her hands. Even more carefully still, she reached inside to extract what was hidden there. Slowly, gingerly, she drew out the stiel. It was the most deadly weapon in the world, a blade forged in the time of faerie in the furnaces of the Grint Trolls. Infused with lethal strains of arcane fire magic, it could penetrate anything, no matter how thick or strong. Nothing could stand against it. It had been in the hands of the assassin Pael in the time of the Shadowen and Walker Bow, and he had used it to kill the daughter of the King of the Silver River. The druid had recovered it afterwards and hidden it here. No one had known where it was since. No one but Grianne Ohmsford. And now Shadea. She held it by its handle, feeling the markings that signified its name where they were carved into the bone plates. The blade gleamed silver bright, its surface smooth and flawless. It had survived thousands of years without a mark. Grianne had kept it concealed for the same reasons as Walker Bow. It was too dangerous to reveal. It was an assassin's weapon, a killer's tool. It belonged, Shadea told herself, in a killer's hands, in an assassin's sheath. It belonged in the hands of a master. She would see that it found its way there. She would see that it was put to the use for which it was intended. The lives it snuffed would be well spent. She sighed. She wasn't being evil, she told herself for a second time that afternoon. She was just being practical. She put the stiel away, closed the chamber anew, and climbed out of Perenor's dark cellars to the light above. Chapter 15. With the decision made to go in search of the Tanaquil, Arran Elicidal arranged for horses to transport the party on the first leg of their journey, and within an hour they were mounted and riding out of Emberon. Seemingly unconcerned about its contents, the druid didn't even bother to close up his cottage, leaving everything pretty much the way it was. Penn had the feeling that the druid wasn't much attached to possessions, and, in the tradition of druids who did service in the field, thought them mostly superfluous. The boy didn't pretend to understand this, having worked hard for everything he had, but he supposed that his own attachments were mostly the result of habit, and not because he valued his belongings all that much. Still, he had to fight a strong urge to go back and lock up. They rode south along the main roadway, stopping frequently to say goodbye to the villagers, Arran making a point of telling everyone he spoke to that they would be gone for several weeks. Penn thought it odd that he would make the information public and was further confused when they departed in the wrong direction and a dozen miles outside the village turned not east toward the charnels, but west. When he finally gathered up courage enough to ask what they were doing, Aran Elicidal smiled. Confusing the enemy, I hope. If they come to Emberon, which I expect they will, the villagers will tell them we left heading south. If they track us that way, they will find that we have turned west. But they will lose our trail when we reach the Rilsong, because we will leave the horses there and catch a barge downriver to the Innisbor and the inland port of Sionad. At Sionad, we will find an airship to take us where we really want to go.
An airship? Penn asked.
An airship offers speed on a direct line and doesn't leave tracks. If I'd had one at my disposal in Emberon, we would have taken it from there. But horses will have to do for now. He laughed. You should see your face, young Penn. They rode all that day and most of the next through the Westland forests before reaching the Rilsong and a way station that offered the use of barge transport downriver. The weather stayed warm and bright, the storm that was lashing Perrinor and the Druid's Keep having passed north a day earlier. They rode steadily, stopping only to eat and sleep, and in that time Penn managed to find discomfort in ways he hadn't dreamed possible. Horses were not a regular part of his life, so riding for such long stretches left him aching from neck to ankles. Having done little riding himself, Tagwin didn't fare much better. Both elves seemed untroubled by the effort, but on the first evening Kyber took time to give the dwarf and the boy a liniment she carried in her pack to ease their pain. Leaving the horses behind at the way station, they boarded the barge late in the afternoon of the second day and set out anew. The Rilsong was deep and wide at that time of the year, and they had no trouble making headway on its turgid waters. When darkness set in, they navigated by moonlight so bright it might have been the middle of the day. Aran could have tied up on the riverbank and let them all sleep, but he seemed anxious to continue on while light permitted, and so they did. Penn was just as happy. He did not care to chance another run-in with Terek Malt. The following day they passed below Arberlon, its treetop spires just visible over the lip of the Carolan. The storied Elfich, the heavily fortified ramp that gave access to traffic coming in from the west, rose like a coiled snake from the eastern bank of the river to the bluff. Elves worked their way through the switchbacks and gates, a steady stream of commerce coming from and going to the Serendanon. Penn found himself thinking about the battle fought between the elves and their allies and the demons from the Forbidding almost 500 years earlier. He stared at the Elfich as they sailed past, trying to imagine the strength of its iron being tested against the frenzy of the demons. Thousands had died in that struggle. The legendary Border Legion had been decimated. The elves had lost one out of every three able men. Their king, Eventine Elicidal, had been killed. Penn wondered if another battle of the same sort was waiting down the road, if in spite of what Kyber said the Elkris was failing again and the demons had found another doorway out of their prison. They passed other boats on the river, and now and again they saw airships sailing overhead, a mix of warships on their way to the Precandoran and freighters on their way to less angry places. The weather stayed sunny and warm. There was no sign of the Gallifile. There was no sign of trouble of any sort. Penn began to think that maybe things weren't so bad. 3 days later they reached the Innisbor, a body of water so vast that even if sun had broken through the clouds long enough to burn away the mists that lay in ragged strips across her choppy surface, the far shores would still have been out of view. It was late in the day when they maneuvered their barge into the landing area just beyond the mouth of the river, arranged for its docking and transport back upriver, and began the 2-mile walk up the lake's eastern bank to the city of Sionad. Thunderheads were forming up again to the west, another storm beginning to build in that mid-season time of storms. That they were commonplace at this time of the year didn't make them any less convenient, Penn thought. If one struck while they were grounded, they would not be able to fly out until it passed. That could take up to several days. Impulsively, Penn asked Aran if they might be able to leave yet that day, but the druid told him they didn't even have a ship arranged as yet and probably wouldn't before week's end. Penn settled into a funk that matched the approaching weather. He didn't like delays, especially where flying was concerned. He was already itching to get back in the air. That was his life at Patch Run, and although he understood he had left that life behind, he couldn't pretend he didn't want it back. Traveling by horse and barge and on foot was all well and good, but flying was what he craved. The sooner he got back in the air, the better he would feel about himself. But just then, patience was needed. Deep twilight had settled in by the time they reached the outskirts of the city, and his stomach was rumbling. They found an inn on a side street not far off the road leading in that served food and offered rooms. It was sufficiently far off the beaten track that R.N. Elicital felt comfortable with staying there for the night. They ate at a table in the back of the common room, and by the time they were finished, Penn's eyes were heavy with sleep. He didn't remember going up to his room afterwards. He didn't remember stripping off his clothes and tumbling into the bed. All he remembered, thinking back on it, was the sound of the rain beating on the shingled roof as the storm arrived.
"It doesn't look like it's ever going to stop," Penn observed glumly, staring out the window of the inn.
The rain fell in sheets as it had been doing all night, flooding the roadways and turning low-lying stretches of waterfront into small inlets. The glass of the window he looked through was sufficiently obscured that he couldn't see more than a dozen yards. Not much of anyone was moving about inside. Nothing was flying. Penn was not happy. Kyber studied the gaming board in front of her, nodding absently at his comment.
"Give it time, Penn. Storms out here are worse than they are inland. But they pass."
She moved a piece to confront one of his.
"If you're worried about pursuit, just remember that if we can't fly, neither can they."
"I don't like being grounded like this," he growled.
"I feel trapped."
He took her piece with one of his own. He thought about R.N. Elicital and Tagwin.
"How long have they been gone now?"
She shrugged, eyes on the board. The druid and the dwarf had gone out early that morning in search of passage. With no one flying, the airship captains would be gathered at their favorite inns and alehouses, passing the time while they waited to get back in the air. A few among them might be looking for business, and out of those, there had to be at least one that the druid would consider hiring. In their situation, discretion was as important as speed, and he wasn't going to sign on with anyone with whom he didn't feel comfortable. He wanted one of the rovers, accomplished mercenaries who knew how to keep their mouths shut. Cyanid was a regular stop for transport from the coast and continuing farther inland to the landlocked cities. Rover captains made the run all the time, and more than a few of them would be here now. Penn and Kyber had been told to stay at the inn, out of sight and trouble. The druid was worried that someone would notice them and remember later, when those who hunted them found their way to the port. The less they were seen, the better, especially Penn with his distinctive long red hair. The inn was crowded, but those gathered were clustered in private groups and engaged in their own conversations. Not much attention was being paid to anyone else.
"When did you start flying airships?" Kyber asked.
She looked up at him.
"You must have been doing it a long time."
He nodded.
"Since I can remember. My mother always flew, and my father as well, after he met her. They took me with them everywhere after I was born, even when I was a baby. I remember learning to steer when I was barely old enough to stand on an upended crate and look over the pilot box railing."
"I wanted to fly," she said, "but my father, when he was alive, and after he died, my brother, insisted that someone always go with me. In a big warship with lots of the home guard for protection, I might add. Even after I began traveling out on my own, old enough to know how to take care of myself, I wasn't allowed to go by airship." He shrugged.
"You haven't missed that much."
She laughed.
"What a terrible liar you are, Penderin. You can't possibly believe that. You're the one who can't wait to get back up in the skies. Admit it."
"Okay, I admit it." He was laughing too.
"But you can make up for what you've missed. I could show you."
He moved another piece, and she responded. She was good at the game, but not nearly as good as he was. He had an innate sense of what she was going to do even before she did. She studied the board intently, aware that she was being backed into a corner.
"Have you thought about the fact that your father and my Uncle Arryn were about the same age we are now when they sailed on the Gerald Shannara?" she said.
"More than once."
"Do your parents ever talk about what it was like?"
"Once in a while. A lot of their friends died on that voyage.
and I don't think they like to remember it. He looked at her. How about your uncle? Does he ever say anything? She shook her head, her brow creasing.
He doesn't like to talk about it either. Because of the seer, I think.
He was in love with her, though he won't say so now.
It's too painful for him.
She cocked her head.
Are you afraid of what we're doing, Pen?
He leaned back, thinking about it.
Was he afraid? What did he feel? He hadn't really stopped to think about it, or maybe hadn't allowed himself, afraid of what he might discover.
No, he answered, then immediately grimaced. All right, yes, but only in a general sort of way. I don't know enough to be afraid of anything specific yet.
Except for that druid, that dwarf. He was pretty scary. I'm afraid of him.
She brushed back strands of dark hair that had fallen forward over her face as she bent to the board.
I'm not afraid. I know some magic, so I can protect us if I have to. Uncle Aaron knows a lot of magic, though he doesn't show it. I think he's probably a match for anyone. We'll be all right.
Glad you think so.
Don't you have some of your father's magic? He had the magic of the wish song. Like your Aunt Grianne, didn't he?
Pen nodded.
True, but he didn't pass it on to me.
I think the bloodline has grown thin after all these years.
He's probably the last.
Just as well, he'd tell you. He doesn't trust it. He uses it now and then, but not much.
He's just as happy I don't have any.
It might help if you did.
Pen paused, considering whether or not he should tell her about the talent he did have.
Maybe.
You could protect yourself a little better. From those renegade druids and their magic. From what you might come upon inside the forbidding, don't you think so?
He didn't reply. They went back to the game, moving pieces until only 8 remained on the board. Pen knew by then that he would win, but he let the game continue anyway. Playing it helped pass the time.
Do you remember what Tagwin said about the Tanaquil giving me the Dark Wand, if I could find it? He asked her finally.
He leaned forward over the board as if concentrating, deliberately lowering his voice.
It's because I do have magic.
She leaned in to meet him, their foreheads almost touching, her elven features sharpened with surprise.
What sort of magic? The wish song? But you said not.
No. Something else. Something different.
He fiddled with one of the pieces, then took his hand away.
I can sense what living things are thinking, what they are going to do and why. Not people. Birds and animals and plants. When they make sounds, noises or cries or whatever, I can understand what they are saying. Sometimes I can make the sounds back, answer them.
She cocked one eyebrow.
That seems to me like it could be pretty important. I don't know how exactly, but I think it could be.
Have you told Uncle Aaron?
He shook his head.
Not yet. Well, you should. He ought to know, Pen. He's a druid. He might know something about it that you don't. Maybe a way you can use it that will help us.
She paused, studying his face.
Are you afraid to tell him? You can trust him, you know.
I know. His eyes locked on hers. I just don't talk about it much. I never have.
They went back to playing, the sound of the rain beating against the window increasing in intensity. All around them, voices and laughter fought to hold their ground. The flames of the lamps on the walls and the candles on the tables fluttered like tiny flags as the wind slipped through cracks and crevices in the wood boarding and gusted through the open door every time someone entered or left.
I'll tell him when he comes back, Pen said finally. He moved his assault piece to confront her control.
Stand down. You lose, Kyber.
They played another game and were in the middle of a third when the door opened to admit a drenched Aaron Elicidal and Tagwin. Shedding water from their all-weather cloaks like ducks come ashore, they hurried over to the boy and girl.
Get your things together, Aaron told them quietly, bending down so that rainwater dripped on the tabletop.
We've found a ship.
They gathered up their gear, strapped their packs over their shoulders, and departed the inn for the ship that the druid had engaged. Better that they settle in at once, so they could be ready to leave when the storm abated, the druid advised. They had to walk from the side street on which the inn was situated back to the main roadway and down to the docks, then along the waterfront to where the ship was tied up at the pier. As they slogged through the downpour, Arryn Elicital provided the details.
The ship is the Skatelow. Appropriate name for its uses, I'd guess. Low and sleek in her hull, raked mast, lots of rigging on the decks. She can't carry much in the way of passengers or freight with all the sail she stores, but she can probably outrun almost anything flying.
Made for our uses, Tagwin grunted, his words nearly drowned out by a sudden gust of wind.
Not much in the way of comforts, but adequate for our needs, the druid continued. Her captain is a rover named Gar Hatch. I don't know anything about him, other than what I've learned from talking with him and what a few on the waterfront tell me. He's got a reputation for being willing to try anything, and they all say he can go places no one else would even think of trying. If I read him correctly, he's done a lot of what we're after, carrying passengers who want to keep it quiet. He's charming, but there's some snake in him as well, so watch what you say. He knows we want to go east to the Lazarene, but that's all I've given him to work with. What he cares about most is the money he will get, and I've satisfied him on that count.
The Lazarene? Kyber asked.
An inland lake at the foot of the Charnels. The first step of our journey.
That's all the rover knows of our plans just yet. They walked on for a while, not speaking, heads bent against the wind and rain. Penn was not only wet, he was cold. He had been out in the weather a lot aboard airships and knew how to dress for it, but in his haste to leave the inn this afternoon, he hadn't given much thought to his personal comfort. He was regretting that oversight now.
Penderyn.
Arryn Elicital had dropped back to walk beside him, letting Kyber and Tagwin go on ahead. Penn hitched up his pack and moved closer so that he could hear. The rain obscured the druid's face and ran off his shoulders in sheets.
I took the liberty of telling Captain Hatch that you had extensive airship experience, he said. I'm afraid I put you on the spot, rather deliberately.
The hood shifted and Penn caught a glimpse of his elven features, somber and intense.
I don't trust this fellow entirely. He's a mercenary, and mercenaries always look out for themselves first. But he was the best I could do, and I didn't want to delay our departure. The longer we wait, the better the chance that those hunting us will get wind of where we are.
Penn nodded.
I understand.
The druid leaned closer.
The reason I told Hatch about your experience is so that he knows at least one of us can determine if he's doing what he's supposed to. I don't want him telling us one thing and doing something else. I don't want him thinking he can put one over on us. I don't say that would happen, but I want to guard against it. I don't know that much about airships. I never did. Your father was the pilot and your mother the navigator when it was needed. I was always just a passenger.
That's never changed.
Kyber and Tagwin know even less than I do. In fact, I think it's something of a miracle that Tagwin managed to reach you on his own.
I thought that too after he told me what he'd done.
Penn blinked away the rain that swept into his eyes.
Stay alert on our journey, Penn, Arryn said.
Don't make it obvious, but keep an eye on what's happening with the navigation of the ship. If anything looks wrong, tell me. I'll deal with it.
Can you do that?
I can do it.
Gar Hatch doesn't know who we are, but that doesn't mean he won't find out. If he does, he might be tempted to make use of that information.
The druids are already looking for you. They've put it about that because of what happened to your aunt, you might be in danger as well, and should be protected. If you're seen, word is to be sent to them immediately.
He hunched his shoulders against the wind.
I gave him only first names, thinking it safe enough at the time, but now I wish I hadn't given him even that. News of the druid search didn't reach Sionid until this morning, but now that it has, Hatch may hear of it. He isn't a stupid man. Be very careful, Penn.
He moved away again into the rain, his cloaked form dark and shadowy in the gloom.
Penn stared after him, slowing.
Be very careful.
Easily said, he thought. Not so easily done. Aware suddenly that he was falling behind, he hurried to catch up with the others. Chapter 16. The storm raged on through the rest of the day and all that night, but by daybreak it had begun to diminish. By the time the general population of Sionid was stirring awake, the Skatelo had cast off her moorings and was underway. Penn and his companions had been huddled below decks since boarding, trying their best to sleep through the storm's fury, and they had not had more than a rain-drenched glimpse of their vessel. Now, with the skies clearing and the sun a bright wash in the east, they came on deck to look around. Their transport was a sloop, a new design for airships, although a very old one for sailing ships. Aran Elicidal had described it accurately. It was low and flat and clearly built for speed. A single mast and spars were rigged to fly a mainsail, foresail, and flying jib. In his travels, Penn hadn't seen much of the latter, another sailing ship feature that had been converted for airship usage. A broad, billowing sail that traditionally captured the wind off the bow and gave the vessel extra thrust, the jib was used by airships to absorb a wider swath of ambient light that could be converted to energy by the diapson crystals that powered the ship. The Skatelo lacked the pontoons that serviced most of the older airships of the catamaran design, relying instead on its pilot's sailing skills and the flatness of its hull to keep it steady in the air. Penn liked the Skatelo right away. It had been modified from its original design considerably to eliminate anything that might slow its flight. Except for the mast and rigging, everything else was tucked away below decks or in storage bins. Even the pilot box was recessed into the hull to cut back on drag. Everything was sleek and smooth, the ship a great swift bird that could hunt or run as needed. It was powered by 8 diapson crystals, the most in use for a ship of only 70-odd feet. Anything more in the thrust might have torn her apart. Even with 8, the captain had to know what he was doing. Gar Hatch did, and he let Penn know it right from the first. Penn had been above decks less than 5 minutes when the captain of the Skatelo hailed him over. "Penderin," he called out from the pilot box. "Stand to, lad. Give an old sailor an ear to bend." Obediently, Penn walked down the deck to the box and climbed in beside Gar Hatch. The rover was a big man, heavy and square through his midsection, with huge arms and legs, a tree trunk of a man. Bushy hair sprouted from his face and head, even from his sizable ears, giving him the appearance of a great woolly bear. When he spoke, he had a tendency to rear back, his stomach thrust out and his chin tucked so far into his beard that his mouth disappeared entirely. What remained visible were his sharp, hawkish eyes, bright and dangerous. "You're a sailor yourself, I'm told," he said, his deep, rough voice rising from somewhere inside his beard. His breath smelled of fish and sea salt. "Been so since you were a small lad, an early old salt. Spent years sailing airships big and small about Rainbow Lake and the rivers that feed her. Good for you." "My parents are the real sailors," Penn said. "I learned what I know from them. They take customers on expeditions into the Eastland." He stopped himself quickly. Remembering Aran Elicidal's admonishment, he was aware that he had already said more than he should have. "I just fly with them once in a while and look after the ships in dock," he finished carefully. Gar Hatch didn't seem to notice. "Grew up that way myself," he said. "Learned what I know from my father and uncles. Sailors all. On the coast, off the Blue Divide, whichever way the wind blew. We flew the big ships mostly, but I had my own skiff when I was your age. Got one of those yourself, your uncle tells me."
"My uncle?"
"Yes, that's right," Penn answered quickly. "A Cat 28. I built it myself."
"Did you know? Good for you, Penderin."
The rover laughed, his belly shaking with the effort.
"Best way to learn about airships is to build one. Haven't got the skills for that myself, but I've helped those who do. I learned keel from the mast quick enough that way, so when I flew, I understood if the lady didn't like the way she was being treated."
Penn grinned. "I like this ship. I've never flown one, but I've seen them and I know how they're made. This one is made to fly fast. Have you run out the string on her?" Hatch roared.
"That's the lad. Ask what matters and no beating around the mainmast. Sure, I've had her thrusters all the way open, and let me tell you, Penderin, she can fly faster than fast. Nothing alive can catch her, save for the big birds off the coast, and they might have to work some to do it. She's a glutton for speed, this one. You're right, though. I gave her all her curves, all her smooth limbs and soft lines. She's my lady, she is. He paused.
You've never flown a sloop, did you say? Lad, that's unconscionable. Do you want to try now?
Penn could hardly contain his excitement.
You'd let me?
A sailor like yourself, born to the air?
Hatch leaned forward, his fish breath in Penn's face.
Take the helm, Captain Penn.
Despite Aran Elicidal's warnings about the big man, Penn was desperate to fly the sloop, so he put aside his misgivings. It wouldn't hurt to accept the offer, he told himself. He was just going to test his skills a bit, try out the controls, and see if he could manage the vessel. He had flown other airships of the same sort, some much bigger. Skateload couldn't be that much more difficult.
Gar Hatch backed away, and Penn stepped up to the helm. He glanced down quickly, noting thrusters, lifts, banking levers, and the like, all familiar to him, though located in somewhat different positions than he was used to. The compass was set dead center above the half-wheel that managed the keel rudder.
"There you be, young Penn," the rover captain declared cheerfully. "A fine and proper set of controls for a fine and proper young sailor. Give her a try, lad."
Penn did so, easing into things slowly, carefully, setting trim before taking the airship a little higher with the lifts. She nosed upward, but he felt the tension in her hull, then a slight shaking. He frowned as he worked to steady her. It wasn't as easy as he had thought. Everything was the same, but the sloop's responses were less certain than he would have liked. He adjusted the thrusters and felt her shake some more. An effort at resetting trim proved unsuccessful. He eased the power back, glancing over at Gar Hatch. The rover's sharp eyes were glittering.
"Not so easy as it looks, is it?" he asked, and Penn could see he wasn't expecting an argument. "Flying a sloop is not the same as flying a Cat-28, or even a warship with pontoons and rams for stability. A sloop needs tender loving care from a master who knows her needs."
He smiled, but even through the heavy growth of beard, Penn could see the teeth behind. He realized with a sinking feeling that Hatch had been testing him. Knowing how difficult it would be for someone unfamiliar with the sloop to sail her, he had enticed Penn into trying so that he could judge the boy's skills. The rover was one step ahead of Aran Elicidal. He knew that Penn had been asked to check up on him, even without having been present at the conversation. Now he had Penn's measure, and the boy had helped him take it. Gar Hatch stepped forward and took back the ship's controls, easing Penn out of the way without seeming to do so.
"You keep in mind, Penderin," he said softly, looking over at the boy as he steadied the vessel anew, "that there's only one captain on this ship. Do that, and we'll get along fine. Now out of the box you go. Back down on the deck with the others. That's a good lad."
Penn left without a word, burning with frustration and shame, so furious with himself that he could have spit. But there was no help for it, and he refused to give Gar Hatch the satisfaction of seeing him react. Fighting to control himself, he stood alone at the starboard rail, his gaze directed resolutely forward, even though he could feel the rover captain's eyes on his back. He should have paid better attention to Aran Elicidal's warning, but that was water over the dam. What mattered was how well he remembered the lesson he had just been taught. Well enough, he promised himself. The next time Gar Hatch tried to make a fool of him, things would turn out differently. It was late in the afternoon of that same day when Cinnaminson came on deck. She climbed up through the hatchway leading from the narrow sleeping quarters below, stepping into the crimson light of the sunset like a shade. Penn was sitting with Kyber at the aft rail, still stewing over the way he had let himself be fooled by Gar Hatch when he saw her. He did not know where she had come from or what she was doing there. He had thought that besides the four who had booked passage, there were only Hatch and two crewmen. Now this apparition had appeared. He stopped talking in mid-sentence, causing Kyber, who had not been paying close attention, to look up from her writing and follow his gaze. She was only a girl,
no older than Pen, younger than Kyber, her slender form wrapped in something soft, gray and green that might have been a long robe and shimmered like the sea. She looked to have woken from a deep sleep, her short, sandy blonde hair disheveled and her face tilting toward the light as if to make certain of the time. Pen thought her beautiful, although he would later revise that judgment to striking, and sometime later to captivating. Her features were delicate but unremarkable and not quite perfect. Still, they intrigued him. What mattered more was the way she moved, not looking at anything while seemingly aware of all. She glided rather than walked, the soft whisper of her gown marking her passage as she came toward them. It was when she had almost reached them that Penn saw her eyes. They were milky white and empty, staring straight ahead at nothing. She was blind. Penn did not know who she was. He did not know her name. What he did know was that he would never forget her. "Are you our passengers?" she asked them, looking off into a space they did not quite occupy. Penn nodded, then realized she couldn't see him. "Yes, two of them, anyway. I'm Penn, and this is Kyber." He had presence of mind enough, though just barely, to remember to use only first names. "I'm Cinnaminson," she told them. "I'm Garahatch's daughter." She stretched out her hand and waited for them to take it, which they did, one after the other. Her smile was winsome and a bit fragile, Penn thought, hesitant and protective at the same time, which seemed right for her condition. But there was strength to her, too. She was not afraid to come up against what she couldn't see. "Traveling to the Charnels," she said, making it a statement of fact. "I like that part of the world. I like the feel of the mountain air, the smell and taste of it. Snow melts and evergreens and ice." "Do you always come on these trips?" Kyber asked, looking doubtful about the whole business. "Oh, yes. Ever since I was 8 years old. I always go. Papa wouldn't fly anywhere without me." She laughed softly, milky eyes squinting with amusement. "I'm an old salt, he tells me, a child of the air and sea." Kyber arched a questioning eyebrow at Penn. "I am surprised he would allow you aboard at so young an age when you could not see to help yourself.